It's Sunday, May 24th. Today, we're looking at a $1.8 billion fund Donald Trump has established for his allies, and why the government is suddenly cutting checks for your local newspaper. Also, hospital ERs are using AI to record your every word, and why that's making patients clam up. Following up on the racing news from earlier this month, we've got a Preakness winner, but no Triple Crown. Donald Trump has established a $1.8 billion fund that functions as a private treasury for his political allies and legal interests. According to the Slush Fund report, this pool of money was created through a legal mechanism where Trump initiated a lawsuit against agencies he currently controls and then settled. The fund is designed to compensate victims of what Trump calls political persecution, including individuals involved in the January 6 Capitol riot. Because the money is being dispersed through the executive branch rather than the court system, it bypasses standard judicial oversight and provides a level of civil immunity for Trump and his family members. Here is what is actually happening. The sitting president sued his own government, settled with himself, and now has nearly $2 billion taxpayer dollars to hand out to whoever he likes. It's being framed as a legal settlement, but since there was no real adversarial process, it's effectively a monarchical mechanism to reward loyalty. The report notes that this fund allows for unilateral disbursements and broad releases of liability that go even further than the traditional power of a presidential pardon. It's reparations for rioters, paid for by the people who had to hide from them in the basement of the Capitol. This puts the GOP in a hell of a spot. Republican lawmakers now have to choose between nodding along to a massive redistribution of tax dollars to insurrectionists or facing a primary challenge from a guy who just gave himself a $1.8 billion war chest. It smells like a shakedown, because it is one. Legally challenging this is going to be a nightmare. Finding someone with the legal standing to sue the president for giving away money is a high bar, especially with the current makeup of the Supreme Court. It's a complete erosion of democratic norms, dressed up in a cheap suit of legal jargon. While that plays out in D.C., the U.S. is significantly ramping up the heat on Cuba. The administration has filed criminal charges against former President Raul Castro, specifically regarding the 1996 downing of civilian aircraft. On top of the legal charges, the U.S. is engaging in military posturing near the island, which the Cuban government is characterizing as a direct pretext for military intervention. Cuba's ambassador to the U.S. recently stated that while they want peace, their sovereignty and political system are non-negotiable. Havana isn't backing down quietly. There have been large public demonstrations in support of Castro and the revolution, and the Cuban government is framing these U.S. moves as a repeat of old strategies used to destabilize other nations. It's a classic Cold War throwback, but with higher stakes given how volatile everything else is right now. The U.S. claims this is about justice for a decades-old aviation disaster, but Cuba sees it as a manufactured excuse to force regime change. Back home, a federal judge has dismissed criminal charges against Kilmar Abrego Garcia, an immigrant who had been deported during the Trump administration. The judge ruled that the Justice Department's prosecution was vindictive and a clear abuse of power. It's a big deal, because it's a rare defeat for the DOJ and a direct rebuke of how the executive branch is using the legal system to hammer individuals for political optics. The Justice Department isn't taking the hint, though. They've already signaled plans to appeal the ruling. Even with the criminal charges dropped, Abrego Garcia is still stuck in deportation proceedings in a separate immigration case. It's a reminder that even when the judiciary tries to check the executive branch, the bureaucracy has a lot of ways to keep the gears turning. Finally, if you've looked at your power bill lately and felt a sense of impending doom, you aren't imagining it. Household electricity costs are set to spike as we head into the summer months. Prices have already surged, and projections show they're going to climb even higher as the weather gets hotter. This isn't just about people cranking the AC, though that's part of it. The Geopolitics, Justice, and Energy Costs report notes that utility companies are passing down the costs of grid hardening, essentially trying to keep the lights on during extreme weather, and dealing with massive new demand from data centers fueled by the AI boom. The human cost of this is getting pretty grim. lower and middle-income families are being hit the hardest, with some people reportedly donating plasma just to keep the lights on, or taking on significant debt to buy backup generators. We're told AI is going to change the world, but right now one of the main things it's doing is making it too expensive for a regular family to stay cool in July. It's an affordability crisis hitting an essential service, and there doesn't seem to be much of a plan to fix the supply side before the heat waves really kick in. Speaking of AI, while it's eating up the power grid, it's also moving into the exam room. Hospital emergency rooms are increasingly deploying ambient AI to monitor patient interactions and automate clinical note-taking. These systems use microphones to capture every word spoken between doctors, nurses, and patients, then use large language models to synthesize those conversations into medical records. The goal is to solve two of the biggest problems in modern medicine: human error during shift changes and physician burnout caused by hours of data entry. According to recent reports, these AI scribes are already showing significant results in freeing up clinician time and improving job satisfaction. But the move toward a photographic memory for the hospital is creating a massive ethical friction point over consent. In a chaotic ER setting, patients are frequently medicated, in pain, or otherwise incapacitated. The reports show that while many hospitals use an opt-out model, the actual opt-out rates are incredibly low. Not necessarily because patients are comfortable with being recorded, but because they are often too overwhelmed to say no. Here's the thing. We are trading the ephemeral nature of a doctor's visit for a permanent, searchable data trail. And that's a shitty deal if you're a patient who needs to admit to something sensitive or embarrassing to get a correct diagnosis. There is a documented chilling effect where patients start self-censoring because they know the room is listening. If you're afraid a recording will be used against you in a legal case or shared with an insurer, you might leave out the one detail that actually explains why you're in the ER. The technology itself isn't foolproof either. These models can hallucinate information, creating medical notes that look professional but are factually wrong. Even a small error rate becomes a massive liability when scaled across a whole hospital system. Clinicians are reportedly already showing lower trust in AI-generated notes compared to those written by humans. Then there's the issue of bias. These AI tools are trained on historical data that often contains the same prejudices found in society. This leads to what's being called testimonial injustice, where an algorithm's output might be given more weight than a patient's actual account of their own symptoms. For marginalized communities who already have a baseline level of distrust in the medical system, the idea of a permanent bias record is a major red flag. The legal side is just as messy. Because these recordings exist, they can become discoverable evidence in malpractice suits. This effectively turns the exam room from a private sanctuary into a deposition room. It's a classic case of the efficiency at all costs mindset. We're so desperate to fix the paperwork problem that we're accidentally blowing up the trust that makes the doctor-patient relationship work in the first place. Looking ahead, this isn't just about transcription. The report suggests the next step is voice analysis, where AI could potentially diagnose conditions based on vocal biomarkers, the tone or pitch of your voice, without you ever giving explicit consent for that kind of screening. We are moving toward a world where the hospital hears everything you say and analyzes everything you don't. It might save some time on the charts, but it's worth asking what we're losing when a private conversation becomes a data point. Now, following up on the Triple Crown chase we've been tracking, the dream is dead for this year. National Treasure took the Preakness Stakes with a front-running trip, which officially means we aren't getting a Triple Crown winner this year. This is the seventh time in the last 8 years that we've seen different winners across the three-year-old classics. Mage has the Derby, National Treasure has the Preakness. And now, we're looking at a wide-open Belmont Stakes, where horses like Forte and Angel of Empire are expected to show up. Honestly, the Superhorse era feels like it's on life support. We have a division with no clear leader, which is great if you're a gambler looking for a price, but a bit of a headache for the sports marketing department. It's hard to sell a rivalry when the leaderboard changes every 3 weeks. While the stars on the track are rotating, the money behind them is hitting record highs. Kentucky's Thoroughbred Development and Breeders Incentive Funds just announced a record $20 million payout in awards for the 2025 racing year. That's a massive chunk of change intended to keep Kentucky the center of the racing universe. What's interesting here is that you don't necessarily have to spend seven figures at an auction to get a piece of that pie. National Treasure, for example, sold for a relatively modest price compared to the top of the market. His breeder, John Gunther, has made a habit of this, producing Grade 1 winners like Liam's Map and Justify from smart mating plans rather than just brute force spending. According to reports on the industry's strategic shifts, the secret sauce isn't just luck. It's a pivot toward obsessive data and specialized management. Gunther's operation at Glenwood Farm is run by his daughter, Tanya, whose background in investment banking has apparently translated well to the world of pedigrees and mating plans. It's a 24/7, detail-oriented approach that treats breeding more like a high-stakes portfolio than a hobby. It's a bit of a reality check for the guys who think they can just throw money at a flashy yearling and buy a trophy. Turns out, deep pedigree research and actually knowing how to handle a foal matters more than the auction spectacle. On the operational side, the industry is currently obsessed with horse welfare. There's a coordinated push to improve veterinary assessments to reduce race day scratches. The goal is to find a middle ground where they aren't scratching healthy horses out of an abundance of caution, but they're also catching injuries before they become catastrophic. It's a shitty tightrope to walk. If they're too strict, the fields are empty and the betting handle tanks. If they're too loose, they risk a PR nightmare. Finally, we're seeing some significant turnover in the human element of the sport. Broadcaster Donna Brothers is wrapping up a long career, and trainer Ian Wilkes is currently making noise with a horse named Burnham Square, who's being touted as a potential turf star. Not for nothing, but with the chaotic state of the dirt division right now, a consistent turf runner sounds like a welcome relief. We'll see if the Belmont adds any more clarity to this mess, or if we're just going to keep shuffling the deck until November. While racing is chasing data, the local news industry is chasing a different kind of lifeline, the government. State governments across the U.S. have begun injecting significant public funding into local newsrooms, establishing public policy as a formal fourth pillar of revenue alongside ads, subscriptions, and philanthropy. According to a new report from Rebuild Local News, more than $129 million has already been funneled into the industry through state-level initiatives like tax credits and government-backed programs. This isn't just a pilot program anymore. It's a fundamental shift in how we pay for the news. Look, the math on local news has been broken for a long time. We've spent a decade watching hedge funds strip mine local papers while we hoped philanthropy would somehow fill a multi-billion dollar hole. It didn't. So now, the government is stepping in because, frankly, the market failed. It's an admission that local reporting is a public good, like a library or a fire department, rather than just a product that needs to disrupt its way to profitability. The data shows these public funds are actually hitting the ground in places big donors usually ignore. In Illinois, for example, an employment tax credit directed two-thirds of its funding to newsrooms with six or fewer employees. That's a massive deal. We're talking about tiny, rural outlets and small-town weeklies, both for-profit and non-profit, that are finally getting a lifeline. It turns out that when you use tax credits instead of hand-picked grants, the money actually reaches the people doing the work, instead of just the major metropolitan outlets with the best fundraising departments. But this brings up the obvious, messy question. Who actually counts as a journalist when the government is cutting the checks? To keep the money away from pink slime sites, those partisan shells that look like local news but are actually just political hit jobs, advocates are pushing for a Swiss cheese model of filters. To get the cash, an organization has to have at least one full-time journalist, carry media liability insurance, and maintain transparent ownership. They're even developing a local journalist index to count actual humans on the ground rather than just counting the number of mastheads. It's a smart move, honestly. If you don't have these guardrails, you're just subsidizing propaganda with taxpayer money, which is a shitty outcome for everyone involved. There's always going to be a segment of the population that gets twitchy when the government starts funding the people who are supposed to hold the government accountable. But when the alternative is a total information vacuum, where corruption thrives because nobody is left to attend a city council meeting, a tax credit for a reporter's salary starts to look like a bargain. We're also seeing some individual wins on the commercial side that suggest the four-pillar model can actually work. In California, Ken Doctor's Lookout Santa Cruz recently reported that it has officially broken even. It's a mix of earned revenue, ads, and support that shows there is a path forward if you're lean enough and local enough. The takeaway here is that the era of waiting for a hero in local news is over. The strategy has shifted to aggressive state-level lobbying and collective action. Groups like Rebuild Local News are telling publishers that if they want to survive, they have to stop acting like isolated islands and start acting like a coordinated interest group. It's cynical, maybe, but it's the first time in years the numbers are actually moving in the right direction. It turns out that saving local news doesn't require a miracle. It just requires a line item in the state budget. So the government is funding the news, and founders are being told to find a new way to fund their family time. A recent report from the Family Office Exchange on entrepreneurial wealth argues that the ultimate dividend for business owners isn't the exit or the IPO. It's the ability to provide peace and presence at home. The report found that entrepreneurs frequently fall into a cycle where they take massive risks for financial gain, only to become addicted to the game of making money. This leads to a situation where the family gets the leftovers of the entrepreneur's energy instead of the best version of it. To fix this, the recommendation is a hard pivot toward what's called homefront security. It sounds a bit like a private militia, but it's actually about building automated systems and hiring teams specifically to buy back time. The goal is a strict separation between CEO mode and family mode. According to the report, if the business isn't actively serving the family's need for presence, the mission has been fundamentally misunderstood. It's a shift from seeing provision as just a paycheck to seeing it as the creation of a stable, quiet environment. Look, the grind mindset is basically a cult, and this is a needed deprogramming. We've all seen the guy who's worth $50 million, but his kids don't want to talk to him because he was scaling during every soccer game. It's easy to get lost in the metrics because numbers are clean and family life is messy as hell. But the point here is solid. If you're building a kingdom and there's nobody left in the castle who actually likes you, you didn't win. You just worked yourself into a very expensive kind of loneliness. Building a team so you can actually go offline isn't optimizing workflow. It's just being a decent person. And before we'll wrap up, here are a few other things on the radar. A few other things worth knowing before you head out. First up, if you haven't thought about estate planning because you think you're not rich enough or old enough to care, you might want to rethink that. Setting up your paperwork now is basically the only way to prevent a total shitshow if you ever become incapacitated. Without a clear plan, your family ends up in a costly, public, and usually bitter court battle over who gets to make your medical and financial calls. It's a lot of paperwork today to ensure your siblings don't spend 3 years suing each other tomorrow. That's the news for this Sunday. Get your house in order and try to stay cool out there.